Okay.
Break for lunch in about an hour, I guess.
So where have I got to now? Well, let's have a look. How about specific topics?
Okay.
Is that all right now?
You bet.
So why fundamental gasless ion chemistry? Well, we've dwelt on that a bit, I think. My background very much was in atomic and free radical gas kinetics and spectroscopy and reaction mechanisms, energetics. So I felt extending it to ions was logical.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested always in mechanisms and energetics. And really getting beyond the cracking pattern problem,
mm-hmm.
was, I thought, of interest. Now, why iron settled on resonance, I think I told you about that.
Yeah, I think we kind of discussed that in some, yeah. in some detail.
All right. Now, chemical ionization, that I always felt was a much more sensible way to do my spectrometry. It's much more like chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas electron ionization, as I said, is rather brute force method of knocking the thing apart.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you produce an ion, which is not what you want to know about. You may cause isomerization at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You may cause isomerization before you fragment. Then you get the fragments and wonder what it is you started with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the classical chemical approach is to take your molecule, which you're interested in, and react it with reagents. And that's what chemical ionization does. So that struck me as a more sensible thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a much wider range of reagents than electrons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware, but Burnaby Munson and I guess Fields mm-hmm. published an early paper when they were working on chemical yeah. ionization and submitted to JAX, and it was rejected because they were in a petroleum company,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and JAX, of course, is very interesting.
Oh, yes, quite.
So I guess they couldn't explain a couple of things that were mm-hmm. minor, but apparently the reviewer thought, well, these guys are a bunch of hooligans who don't know what they're doing, can't make any sense out of it, and why should we publish this garbage? So, and it's one of the things that I found rather curious. If you look carefully, you'll find that most really important advances, when they're first mm. proposed to either a granting committee or an editorial review, they'll frequently be rejected because it's too far outside the box.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of sad that that's the way science has to progress. But so they obviously they got it published, and obviously chemical ionization became a very important.
Yes, it's very important. But here it's selective, it's controllable in the type of reactions, type of energetics.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a lot more with it. And as I put, you react with a molecule of interest in mm-hmm. its ground state,
mm-hmm.
which is what most people want to know about.
Mm, yes.
So that's why we were pleased when we could do the double bond work, because that's really almost like classical organic chemistry.
Right.
And also the reaction of the oxygen for minus ion,
mm-hmm.
which were quite peculiar. Then why tandem mass spectrometry? Because it allows one to select specific reactant and product ions rather than looking at the whole mess where mm-hmm. you don't know what came from what. And so hopefully it gives you detailed information on reaction mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at the resultant mass spectrum, you now have a method of saying what came from what.
Yeah.
Whereas just the standard spectrum, if you're clever like Fred, you can work that out. If you're not. And later it became essential for use with soft ionization techniques when one had to use collision-induced decomposition.
Mm-hmm.
See, when I first started collision-induced decomposition, the motivation was because Henry Rosenstock and his friends were concerned about how many of the metastables were really true unimolecular things and how many weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So I started that, and then the quasi-equilibrium theory said that the fragmentation was independent of the way you put the energy in. So, okay, let's put it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And my first paper was actually to show that the spectrum I got for, I think it was tridiuter toluene, was extremely similar to what you got from electron ionization at 50 eV.
Mm-hmm.
So I could say that collision-induced decomposition gave you very similar information to what electron ionization gave you.
Mm-hmm.
To which, of course, the assembled throng said, so what? Why bother?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I was smiling once Fab came along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So once the soft ionization techniques came along, collision-induced decomposition, which I've been playing about with for some time, suddenly became everybody's favorite.
Sure, game. Because now you had you needed something to get those fragments that everybody didn't want to look at before, or if you just kind of didn't recognize it.
Mm. Oh, here comes the postman. Now, why Fab? Well, the main thing, of course, it extended the mass range considerably, for me, gave me a extra push with the tandem and CID techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And, for the first time, you could start to talk to the biologists.
Well, that's the thing that Fab provided, was in a whole class of the molecules that you'd never get to fly. You know, and I did this chart which showed the number of applications of Fab within years of two or three years after it was published, and it just takes off like a rocket, because people, well, it was easy to build a Fab source for the most part. I mean, a lot of people, if they had an FIFD source, they were halfway there anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and and the instrument companies hopped on it right away as well. So,
well, come back to Fab in a minute or two when I talk about interaction with Alan Quayle.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think it stopped you having to worry about derivatization.
Mm.
You know, trimethyl silyl ethers and things.
Yes. I remember that whole era.
It added 72 or 73 mass units or something per hydroxyl group.
Right. I'd like to say, spend a little bit of time talking about surface-induced collisions. I mean, this, in my sense, this is something that people did, but I don't think it really is caught on as significantly as collision-induced.
No.
And so how did you do surface-induced?
Well, you bounce things off the electric sectors.
Okay.
But I don't think we learned anything very exciting from it. You could do it.
Mm.
But we were not interested in the surface. We were interested in the things that were bouncing onto the surface. So I think the gases were just as good,
really. So it was another thing you could do, but didn't really provide you with anything.
No, we weren't solving any problems with that.
Except perhaps, I mean, one of the problems with gas collision process is the cross section isn't always that great.
And
when you collide with a surface, then you should, in theory, get a better cross section, but then maybe things also stick to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's interesting you mentioned the cross section stuff. Almost everybody used helium to begin with, on the grounds that it didn't deflect your ions out of the beam, so you didn't lose them.
Mm-hmm.
That, we found, the heavier the ions you worked with, the less it was important, because they were big and they just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started working on things like sugars, we began with helium and didn't get very good results, but when you moved to argon, you got much better results.
Hmm.
So I think much of the early mythology, if you like, of CID was done on small molecules. Well, you did have small ions. You didn't have to worry about knocking them out of the ion beam. So helium was the best bet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use things like argon or xenon, xenon was expensive, but you could try it, you certainly got a lot more energy in, but your ions scattered all over the place. But when you got the bigger biological ions, I don't think it mattered as much. And because they were big, like sort of sponges moving along, they gave a good thump with an argon or a xenon atom, then they wobble about and bits would drop off, and that's what you wanted. So actually, we published a paper on you know, how it was better to use heavier collision partners with, I think it was sugars, I can't remember now, actually. I think it was carbohydrates or some sort.
Yeah, I think the Q-talk we had at WashU, the collision cell was used argon in the collision cell for that estimate. That was a completely separate gas system, you know, that was set up just for, and they did use argon, so. There you're doing the biological.
And with a Q-TOF, you presumably don't have to worry about slips.
But with
that, again, it's a problem with magnetic sectors.
Yes, that is an issue that. Now
you've got impact of mouldy, as I say. We had a very ordinary mouldy instrument. Never terribly satisfactory, I didn't think. And I suppose my interest was such that I never got very involved in mouldy. I found electrospray so much more interesting. And
when did you first start working with electrospray?
When I got my Quattro, really.
Oh, okay.
Prior to that, I think we could mess about a bit with the electric sectors, but it was difficult. With the magnetic sectors, it was difficult. But that was really what I think propelled the use of other mass analyzers.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now there's this kind of a dichotomy that we're you have this what they call what. At the tip of my tongue, APCI and electrospray. So they're kind of the same but different. Atmospheric pressure chemical ionization. And electrospray. So you were primarily using the electrospray.
Yes.
Did you do any APCI work or?
I don't recall any, no.
So it seems my recollection is that APCI is a viable ionization technique for certain classes of compounds that are not so whereas the electrospray is typically for the more poor
species.
Okay, so although the sources are very similar, they're really different ionization techniques.
Yes, I suppose since we tended to go specifically biological and peptides and proteins, we went entirely to electrospray work. Well, most significant analyzer developments. God, I hadn't anything written down for that, but I just said recently the terrific step forward made in time of flight. FT is very interesting, but not for every lab, in my opinion. It is expensive, it's difficult to get into, and the ease with which QTOF type instruments can be used by all sorts of people, I think, has made that quite a significant advance. I mean, I remember time of flight before they had reflectrons, before they had source focusing, where you were lucky to get 150, I think. I mean, they always showed you the mercury isotopes.
Oh, yeah.
Just because they didn't fragment.
Yes.
You put normal butane in, you've got about 150 as a resolving power.
Yeah.
And then they managed to get up to about 400. And the first one I was offered, in fairly recent times, it was about 400. Brooker offered us one. I said, no thanks. wasn't really worth working with.
Mm-hmm. So they said Bruker had a time of flight?
Yes, it was a relatively small thing. But once you came to QTOF type things and the source focusing devices, I forget what they were called.
I mean, your Benex used to have what you call a time lag focusing, which is basically the same thing
as
the modern focusing method. Mm. It was reinvented for the new era of time of flight. Mm. I mean, I remember when time of flight essentially disappeared from the scene. When I first started working at McDonnell Douglas, that's all we had was a time of flight. And you go to a mass spec conference and they kind of look down their nose at you because you had this toy, you know.
Well, they never caught on over here because, of course, AI and VG really dominated the field.
Mm, yes.
And time of flight regard is a bit peculiar.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely changed.
Yeah. And people might use it for things like, I know, shock tube work to sample.
Yeah.
But serious mass spectroscopists didn't bother with time of flight.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And like I say, when I went to these conferences, I just kind of ignored you because, oh, yeah, it was a time of flight. And what did you do with that? You know, the thing that is interesting, if you look at that literature, is that came from, say, those Bendix instruments, is just about every one, about the first thing they say in the introduction is they modified the instrument. So I think it was a great tool for people who wanted to do things a little out of the ordinary.
Well, that's what I applied for my money for when I got the ICR, you see, to play with a time of flight.
That's right. Yes.
John said he'd seen so many Bendix that were not working, and he did not think I should get involved with one.
That's interesting. So I mean the revolution in time of flight mass spectrometry to me is almost like a miracle because I know at a time when people just predicted that the future of that analyzer technique was totally dead, that sectors were going to win the day and part of both, you know, were okay for certain applications, and time of flight was just totally nothing.
Yeah. But the improvement in the source design and the reflectron and the multiple pass things.
It's really amazing. It's really amazing. I can't believe there's always far. It's really, I mean, I've seen it, I've used one, but it just is just totally mind-boggling to me.
And they're relatively easy to use now. And sensitive.
Yes.
And that's really what killed the magnetic sectors, I think. I remember Kratos struggling to show they could just about detect a picogram of things.
Mm-hmm.
A picowatt, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, the old sector people have joined the time of flight business. I mean, Kratos has the time of flight, Bruker's time of flight, VG, Micromass, Waters, whatever you want to call them, time of flight.
Waters, yeah.
Yeah, Waters. And then, what about, have you heard much about this new Orbitrap?
No, I didn't know of it until a couple of days back they were talking about it when I had dinner with Ron Heeren and Jim Scrivens and Peter Sadler. And they talk about it then. It's good for getting molecular weights, is that right?
I am not sure. Mike Gross had some money to buy a new instrument, and I know that he spent a lot of time researching the Orbitrap and the FT-ICR. They already have an FT-ICR instrument, Lab 2, in his lab at Washington University. And they got a QTOF, so they have these instruments. Of course, the FT-ICR has got resolving power that goes way beyond what the QTOF will do, but they kind of were hot on the Orbitrap, and then they kind of cooled off, and now I think they got back onto it. One of the issues is you don't need the magnet.
Yeah.
So you're saving yourself a lot of liquid helium.
Maintenance time.
You know.
Cost, yes.
Yeah. So those costs are down. I think they managed to get the cost of the instrument up in the same range as an FT instrument. And my understanding is the mass measurement accuracy is good. From what I've been able to gather from the little bit of that I've read about it, is that the below a mass 1,000, it's not as sensitive and as accurate, but above a mass 1,000, it competes well with the FTICR. And I think it may give the FT machines a pretty good run for the money when you know enough people have got them.
Was the impression I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And the accuracy of mass measurement, though, still seems to be a problem to beat 1 ppm, I think.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I mean, magnetic sectors were essentially getting there years ago.
Yeah, but at the massive range, you know. Because now people are wanting to do, well, particularly if you try, I don't know how an RB trap would work with their, what is it, the top-down or bottom-up, I forget which one. I guess the top-down is the one where you try and look at the molecular ion for the protein, as opposed to the bottom-up where you slice it up in pieces and look at the pieces to build it back up. That's Fred McLafferty has been promoting this top-down approach, where you look at the molecular ion in of the protein or large peptide, and use this ECD, electron capture dissociation technique, to fragment it. He likes that because he likens it very much to what you would get from an electron impact breakdown, so you get to see the significant fragments and so on. So he has a disciple at the University of Illinois who just received an award at the last Pittsburgh conference. I know his name and I can't bring it to mind, but basically Neil Kelleher is doing this top-down proteomics.
We had one of his disciples give us a lecture on it 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
Zubarov.
Okay. Yes.
So I think he's interested in possibly coming here. I don't know whether he's quite what they're looking for, but he was giving a lecture, and I heard him only 2 weeks ago. Talking about ECD work.
Okay, so you got to have a sense of what's going on there. So, I mean, the thing that's amazing to me is the continual evolution. You know, I mean, I know people who at one time says, well, you know, mass spectrometry is stuck in as a technique for using and analyzing hydrocarbons, or doing small molecules, or doing non-biological samples. And it's, everyone who has written it off has been basically shown wrong.
About every 5 years it takes another leap.
Yeah, and it's like a technique that won't quit. Now, of course, they get all these combination estimates that are almost like alphabet soup, you know, with quadrupoles and linear traps and orthogonal time of flights and FTEs, and people are putting these things together in ways that they're doing this drift experiment, the and mobility thing.
Oh yeah, well this is what done here. Mm-hmm. So that Jim Scrivens does that.
Yeah, and then combining that with the mass spec. So
in fact, had one of our funding agencies moved a bit faster, I've been doing some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I retired before they came up with any money.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an aside, we're interested in mad cow disease. And mad cow disease is thought to arise from misfolding of proteins, which, on the whole, don't change chemically.
Right.
So, how do you detect that? Iron mobility.
Mm-hmm.
So we put together a deal with Mike Bowers, who is piloting this a lot in Santa Barbara, and the department here, and we applied for money to work on it, to try to produce a test for mad cow disease before the person or the cow had died.
Mm-hmm.
So you did not have to have someone's brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that fell foul of the funding people, because was it pure or was it applied?
Mm-hmm.
So the pure people said, this is really not for us. You know, this is the DEFRA can fund this. And DEFRA said, but there's a lot of pure work got to be done on getting the stuff right and so on. And after about 2 years, I retired. Mm-hmm. I think it took 3.5 years for some money to come through.
Mm-hmm.
But I did a lot to write the original proposal for that.
Mm-hmm.
It just got put back and put back and put back. And eventually, I think the chemists, the biologists, and the government all had to fund bits of it or something.
I see. It kind of touches in too many different areas.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But certainly iron mobility, I think, really is quite useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Walters are producing some quite nice instruments to do that. Mm-hmm. And Jim's getting one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Right, so that gets us on to personal interactions, which I have quite a lot to say.
Okay.
So let's start with John Brynan. Well, he was about the first person I interacted with. And as I think I mentioned last night, I remember going to Blakely to hear him talk, and his group talk, about broad metastable peaks, which they were seeing in nitrophenols at the time. And they gave an analysis on how the breadth of the peak varied with the accelerating voltage and how you could deduce the energy release. And I found that very interesting because, as I told you, I'd then did a bit of work on the MS-10 and got these broad peaks, which I never published. I wrote up in a conference on MS-10 users, which I'm sure nobody ever read. But when our MS-9 appeared in 1964 in November, we got it working, and I was able to submit a paper, or a note rather, in the following January on the doubly charged benzene ion, because by modifying their treatment, I was able to show how you could look at both fragments. So my technician, I know, thought I'd gone mad. I said, well, put some benzene in, plenty of it, and start scanning down from about mass 110.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, that's a waste of time, isn't it? I said, what if you wait? And mm-hmm. around 101 and 102, a nice broad metastable peak came up, mm-hmm. which was the 63 plus ion from the double charge.
Mm-hmm.
I said, now keep it going right down. And at 5.7, there was the metal. Mm-hmm. So you could see both. Mm-hmm. And so that this showed, the double charged benzene ion did fragment to the two bits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen the metal plus on the MS-10 with that mm-hmm. voltage mm-hmm. scanning. So then we looked at a lot of aromatic ions. And
so was this one of the first times that people observed a fragment ion in a...
I think it was the first time we...
higher mass than the parent?
I believe so.
Because it's kind of counterintuitive. Yep. I mean, like the guy says, why should you start at 100 plus? Why would you find a mass larger than the electron?
Well, where does it normally come at M2 squared over M1?
Mm-hmm.
It comes at 2 M2 squared over M1, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's going at twice the normal speed because it's doubly charged, and when it fragments, it's still going at nearly twice the normal speed.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it appears at a different place in the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think we were the first to show that you could see both bits.
Mm-hmm.
But this then brings me on to another gripe I have about mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you publish?
Mm-hmm.
We put this in Chemical Communications, and that was referred to quite a lot because it was a first observation. We then observed about another 20 or 30 from various aromatics. And where do you publish those? We published them in the Transactions of the Faraday Society.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly anybody has ever referenced that paper. We have pictures of them and the whole table of 20 or 30 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But Faraday Society readers don't do mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
And mass spectrometry people don't read the Transactions of the Faraday Society. So the paper was essentially lost.
Why did you select that journal?
It's the standard physical chemistry journal in Britain. And we thought it was physical chemistry, you see. Really. But it didn't impinge on anybody, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to John Bynan about where you published, and he said, well, it was a difficulty. Yeah, he published in Zeitschrift für Naturforschung. And I said, well, why?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, they accept the papers. So mm-hmm. I published one or two things in there, and I know Mick Barber did, and he did. But I never got any referee's comments back, which worried me. And I think the editor decided whether or not it was publishable.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really feel comfortable about having papers where I didn't even get a thing saying, yes, I've read this and it seems okay.
Mm-hmm.
You just suddenly got a thing saying it's accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us found it difficult to know where to put things. And really, in a sense, that's why we started mass spec journals.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first one you guys started?
I think it was probably Organic Mass Spectrometry, the international journal of mass spec and ion processes. But again, you see, it's separating us from mainstream science,
mm-hmm.
which I've always felt is perhaps one of our mistakes.
Yeah, it would be interesting to do an analysis of the journals in which mass spec papers appear over mm-hmm. the decades to see if there's, I mean, I don't guess a lot of it gets into JAKS or the typical, quote, chemistry mm-hmm. journals in the United States.
Analytical chemistry gets quite a bit.
Analytical chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Then JASMAS.
Well, but JASMAS mm-hmm. is also basically a specialty journal.
Yes, yeah.
You know. Of course, some of these journals now are, you know, got blinders on focus light.
Well, Jim Scriven was only saying the other day that really one of the best journals for content is the International Journal, but one of the poorest journals for referencing is the International Journal. The impact factor is very low.
Mm-hmm.
You put something into Rapid Communications, which most people regard as a rather, you know, low quality journal, and all sorts of people will read it, all sorts of people will reference it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in citations, mm-hmm. that's the one to go to.
Mm-hmm.
But the International Journal, I'm afraid, is a bit like the Faraday was for me.
Mm-hmm.
You publish in there, but it rarely gets referenced.
Yeah. Hmm.
It's too physical. You know, it's too much an instrument, too theory.
Yeah.
It's not sort of what happened when I put my peptide into the mass spectrometry.
Yeah. Well, I think, is there a biological mass spectrometry journal now?
Mm.
It sounds vaguely familiar, I think.
Yes, BMSS. BMSS, rather.
Yeah.
Well, that, rather scathingly, was regarded as OMS failed for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was my first link with John. And then we had the Venezuela trip together. But and the Ljubljana one.
The where was that other second?
The Ljubljana one, the Josef Stefan Institute I mentioned earlier.
Oh.
But we were just getting together to get him a visiting professorship in Sheffield when I moved to Warwick, so we managed to get him one here.
Oh, okay.
So he then came for about a 5-year period and gave one or two lectures.
So he started at Swansea. He was already at Swansea then, or was he?
Yes, yes.
Because he had this kind of interregnum between ICI and Purdue. And
oh, yes, I think he went to Swansea a little after that. That was right, because he still lived in Buxton. And I know he thought Buxton to Sheffield was easier than Buxton to Warwick.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, then there was the Purdue affair. So I went to Purdue when he was there. And actually had a chat with the chairman about whether I'd be interested in going. Mm-hmm. This was before Graham went. But I have to say that Purdue didn't attract me. I was out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, right.
And really, the idea of living there, no, I couldn't imagine living there.
It's this American tradition of land-grant schools that, you know, are put in the middle of nowhere, as you say, because it's the land is there. I think Purdue's probably a land-grant school.
Mm.
And it's like Cornell, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. You know, but so many schools, the University of Illinois, you know, they're all located in Hastings compared to the big city. So,
yeah, I was there giving a seminar, and John said, "Well, why are you here? Never have a chat with the chairman, you know, see what you think of the place and so on." So I think he was coming to the end of his time.
So this professorship he got from the Royal Society was, I gather from my conversation with him, was something of a surprise to him. At least that's the way he expressed it to me. These things don't come.
They're quite rare.
They don't hand them out like candy. So.
No. No, it was a great achievement to get it.
It was a very significant achievement. I just wonder what the mechanism behind selecting people for these things must be.
No, I'm afraid I wouldn't know. I'm not in that category.
You don't have any insight as to what it is, but obviously someone is looking at people's scientific record and is thinking that this fellow is worthy of receiving this honor, and it's really a tremendous honor.
Yes, I haven't really known many of these. Alan Carrington was one. He worked on electron spin resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And long ago, A.G. Gaydon, who worked on spectroscopy and dissociation energies.
How do you spell the last name?
G-A-Y-D-O-N. These I know him. He's my external examiner for my DPhil. And he wrote to me and said, got these new bands, have you please bring your photographic plates along so I can have a look at them at five as to go along carrying my plates. He was an eminent spectroscopist who had very limited eyesight owing to an explosion problem. He wrote a nice book, Dissociation Energies, which I remember reading with considerable interest. It was at a time when the dissociation energy of nitrogen was still either 9.76 electron volts or 7.8, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
It depended how you interpreted the spectrum.
Uh-huh.
And Kistiakovsky showed it was 9.76 with his shunt tube work.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sorry, that's beside the point.
And so then, when you came to work, John had a 5-year appointment as a
visiting professor. Yes. And that meant we had joint meetings. We used to hire a minibus, and my group went off to Swansea for the day, and his group came here for the day about every 3 months. And we each got students to present their work to each other.
So this was a day-long affair?
Yes.
And basically...
We just saw how long it takes to drive.
Sure, yeah.
If we left at 7, we'd be down there for about 10, leave about 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so
the students, really, this would have been a great opportunity for them to... get some criticism on their
and also to present a 20-minute talk in circumstances which didn't really
count.
Worry them too much.
Yeah.
They can make their mistakes
right.
Among friends.
And get some good feedback from people who were definitely...
And they could see how other people did things.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, very common. And we had a joint postdoc for a while as well, Dibitz and Sharma.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked quite well for a while.
So at the end of 5 years, then, you... That
you couldn't carry on. These were supposed to be a one-off five-year thing. You couldn't renew them, as it were. The universe didn't allow that.
Okay. So they didn't want you to be too comfortable with his arrangement.
Yeah, quite. Yeah. You couldn't sort of have your friends coming forever. So then we've kept in touch at conferences after that. Mm-hmm. And then it was the ICR connection as well, I mentioned earlier. The next one you had down was Klaus Biemann. Mm-hmm. Very little, actually, to do with him. Primarily because he'd always seemed to be working on peptides.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, for many years I didn't have anything to do with biological stuff.
Mm.
I visited his lab once, I can't remember whenabouts now, and I met him occasionally at conferences.
Sure.
But I have to say, I don't think we interacted very much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, got on very well with him, don't get me wrong. But
did you use his book at all?
Not very much, no.
What about Biden's book? I mean, they were basic.
Not a lot, because it was really.
Didn't cover the kind of thing you were
interested in. No, it was a technique. I mean, it gave a detailed description of the galleon inlet system, for example, which I remember using back in the dark days.
Yeah, in the dark days.
Not recently. No, McClafferty's book and Jurassic, Buzz gave us Jurassic Williams. Got very well thumbed. And as I say, McClafferty's Advances in Mass Spectrometry was about 62 or 3, I think. I found that a good book. But Beeman's was obviously a good book, but not on the subject area I worked in. I mean, it was very well regarded, I know.
But oh, yeah. I think that really kind of sealed his appointment at MIT. I think when he wrote that, he was, you know, basically tenureless. And
a book I did read quite a bit, or two books, A Field of Franklin, of course, and a book edited by McDowell. That had quite a lot of chapters in by different people.
MCDOW?
Yeah.
ELL?
Yes, he was at UBC, wasn't it? Yeah. University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Yes, that was a well sung book, if I was dropping to bits by the time I finished with it.
Yes.
And Kaiser's book, I remember.
Yeah, Bob's, yes.
And McDowell's book, that was fairly physical. But as far as interpretation was concerned, there was nothing that would beat Jurassic's book, I thought.
Yeah. And then they had this huge series of papers that went on forever.
Yes.
Number 57 or what, I can't remember how all they went, but...
Well, we had an ESR chap in Britain, Martin Simmons, who... I think published something like 300 or 400 papers. You know, had studies in ESR spectrometry, part 378.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Then we come to Mick Barber. Mick actually was at Queen's when I was, but he was 3 years behind me.
At
Queen's College, Oxford.
He was at Queen's College, Oxford.
Yeah.
As well.
So I first met him when he was there. As an undergraduate, I just started my part two when he appeared in college.
So was he in physics or chemistry?
He was in chemistry.
He was in chemistry.
Because he actually followed the same course that I did, 3 years behind me.
Okay.
Because he also worked with Jack Linnett, who did his DPhil with Jack. And we met a bit more than we might have done because we were both interested in music.
Oh, okay.
And the college had a musical society, the Egglesfield Musical Society, which gave one concert a term, and we both sang in that.
Okay. So this was a choral group that was composed of just people in Queen's College? Or
No, people from outside could join, but most of the basses and tenors were from Queen's.
And Mickey Barber was in there with you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was much more musical than I. I think he could play the organ if I remember right. I can't remember now, but
too much foot coordination for me.
Quite.
So that was a very early association.
Yes. Yes. And I remember as I was finishing, he was just about to start his part two. But some of his work then actually led on to much of my early work. He and Martin Elliott showed how he could use the a knob on the MS-9 called the Delta V knob, which allowed you to vary the accelerating voltage by about 2%. And this enabled you to look at metastables in the first free region if you were losing a hydrogen atom or a hydrogen molecule.
The small.
Yes. And they were very difficult to see because they didn't move very far down.
Sure.
In the spectrum, you see.
So this had been close to the microion region.
Yeah. So this was Barber and Elliott, ASTMS, 1964, Montreal. And they showed how you could use the Delta V knob, you see. And I got our machine, and I said to Martin and Mick, It's a pity this delta V knob doesn't work a bit more than 2%, isn't it? Can't you make it 50% or 100%?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know about that. And I said, well, I'd like you to. So Martin devised a circuit which enabled me to vary the voltage by 50%.
Mm.
And that was my first paper on benzene.
Mm-hmm.
Metastase was in the first retro region, which was erroneous.
Hmm.
Because Martin's circuit wasn't quite right.
Mm-hmm.
You had 270 volts on either side of the electric sector,
right.
Plus and minus.
Mm-hmm.
Zero in the middle.
Right.
As you varied the accelerating voltage, unfortunately, the zero moved.
Mm-hmm.
So when your ions went down the middle, they were starting to experience a retarding potential.
Mm-hmm.
And that made one difference in 80. So I found myself having to explain why C686 double plus could somehow produce C687 double plus. Where was it picking up the proton and the hydrogen? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway, Martin said he was very sorry, but there was a slight error in his circuit. He then produced the right circuit. And things were fine thereafter.
Now, was he at...
So he worked with Mick Barber at AEI.
So Barber went to AEI?
Yeah.
So originally he was in the instrumentation side of things?
Yes, yes. He,
with Elliot, Martin Elliot?
Yeah, yeah. See, he would leave Queens in 61.
Mm-hmm.
So I left in 58.
And then did he go right into...
I think he must have gone into AEI then.
Okay, so when you were talking to these guys about this, then they were in a position to actually make the change yes. You suggested.
Yes, and so it was 64 that he did the work with Martin, and mm-hmm. It was late 64 that I said, I'd like this knob to be mm-hmm. much bigger, please.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me how to do it? Because, of course, it was a surface instrument, and
I
bore holes in myself.
Yes.
So anyway, they did that, and then they financed a student to work with me. To demonstrate how useful it was, and then of course everybody started to do the same thing. And once we showed how you could see metastable all over the place.
And these would have been ions that decomposed right out of the ion source.
Yes, yes. And it was the summer of 65, then I went over to work with Gene Futrelle and did the same with him on looking at the tropidium ion formed in different ways,
mm-hmm.
from different precursors. So everybody started doing the same thing about the same time, but mm-hmm. I think we were among the first to show how useful it was.
Well, I have all of those old programs and abstracts, so I can certainly pull up this paper, or abstract anyway. And,
well, Barber and Elliott, ASD in Montreal, 1964, was the Delta V
mm-hmm.
paper,
mm-hmm.
and they are usually given credit for using that method first, and then I'm given credit for having extended it
mm-hmm.
to eventually we extended quite a lot
mm-hmm.
by filling them out with a circuitry. We could do to begin with, we could only do losses up to half the mass, but then I got so you could do losses up to 3/4 the mass.
Yes, yeah, so the delta V circuit basically just changes the accelerating potential.
Yes.
So but
without changing the electric sector.
The electric sector. So you want the electric sector to stay at what it would be
yes.
for the normal accelerating mm-hmm. potential, and by having this broad sweep in the delta V circuit, you're able to change the energy of the ions that come out of the ion source.
Yes.
Relative, and then so when the decomposition occurs in the first fuel-free region, the energetics will be such that...
You looked at ions of the same energy all the time, because the same energy,
which has been defined by the SA plates.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, however they were created, you always were going to have the same energy.
Well, you dropped it to 4 kV normal operation.
Mm-hmm.
Then you started to raise the accelerating voltage to 5 kV, then a bit dropped off, so it was only 4 kV's worth going through the
filter.
Then to 6 kV, a bit dropped off, it was still only 4 kV going through. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So by the time it was 8 kV, half of it had to drop off to get through the 4 kV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we could go up to, say, 100 giving 50.
Mm-hmm.
then I could fiddle with the circuit to get to, if you go down to the 2 kV operation, I could go to 100 giving 25.
Mm-hmm. So that was setting the ESA plates at a lower value than normal.
Instead of having 540 volts across them, you have 270 across them, then 135 across them.
And then this machine had an 8 kV normal operation. Normal operation. Mm-hmm. Day. Okay. This makes a lot of sense.
Now, I worried them occasionally. When we got on to working with metastable peak shapes,
mm-hmm.
What one finds is if you have the release of very little energy, your metastable peak looks like that. And as the energy release gets bigger, it does this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can play with the electric sector voltage and change the shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. And I remember putting the best part of a kilovolt across the electric sector. And put old Martin, he had a fit. He said, you know, whether the insulation would stand that.
Yeah, it's not exactly designed. I mean, 507, was it 540 for the...
Yeah.
It's only twice as much.
I think I got about 800 or 900 across it. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, with Mick Barber and Martin Elliott, I had a lot of fun. We worked together for a lot of times. And also, to begin with Brian Green before he joined VG, and with Alan Wolstenholme. So my interaction with Kratos was very intense.
Mm-hmm.
We worked together on all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we used this Delta V variation. We didn't use the Delta V knob. I had a potentiometer which went from 0 to 999. And the number in it, if you put one in front, gave you the fraction you'd lost. So 1.444, I tell you immediately what was going on. We did fragmentation of peptides that way in the early days, and I think they used a limited data system to try and analyze things.
So did you rely strictly on metastables, or did you have a collision energy in the first field theory region?
To begin with, this was metastables.
Oh, metastables originally. Mm-hmm.
And that was in 65 and 66. And collision-induced decomposition, I didn't start until about 67.
Mm-hmm. You've been using the same technique?
Yes. As I said, my first thought was, let's see if I can see if this goes up much, if I've got some gas in and all hell broke loose. So that's really Mick Barber then. And
were you privy to his work on the development of the FAB?
Yes. I'll come on to that in a minute, if I may. Then we had Henry Rosenstock, and as I've already said, I visited NBS quite a few times, talked to him and Vernon Deibler and John Heron.
So Vernon Deibler is the name going back to the beginning of American mass spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember him, yes.
Okay, because I looking at the early programs, the ASTM meetings, his name's quite popular.
Well, I was interested in apparent potentials and so on. We did some work on that ourselves, ionization efficiency curves and so on. And as I say, Henry always referred to his book as the Book of Random Numbers.
This is how Henry referred to it.
Yes. Said, no, I mean Book of Random Numbers.
That's rather interesting. Maybe somebody else calling it that, but yeah, he called it that.
And, you know, I used to have entertaining discussions with him about these things, and then, unfortunately, as I say, he died at this NATO meeting in Portugal in 1982. But I certainly followed a lot of his work and was interested as a spectator, I can say, in the quasi-equilibrium theory. I never actually doing anything with it, but seeing what it led to, and his work with Fahaftig and company.
So, you just remember meeting Deibler.
Yeah, Vernon Deibler.
You didn't really have much of an interaction with him?
No, I mean, I met him once or twice when I visited the NBS. Just,
So you know,
it was really good to mix with, actually see the people you read about.
Oh yeah, definitely. So you interacted with Rosa Stock. You didn't do anything together or collaborate.
Oh no.
I kept abreast of each other.
We always talked at conferences, and yeah, I talked about what we were doing. He would make his comments and so on. And always got on very well with him. He was a very nice chap. Then we get to Nico, and Nico Niebring, as I told you, I first got to know when I got this letter from him, very formal, saying, could he please visit my laboratory to see this Delta V knob, and or the Jennings knob, as he referred to it.
Jennings.
Actually, he put it on his MS-9 in Amsterdam. It was referred to as the Jennings knob.
Okay.
But it was good fun.
It's a certain distinction.
I've known it for so long, for about 40 or 50 years now.
So he kind of came in as a formal...
Yes, I think he was just starting out, and this was about 66 or so, 67. And we visited each other quite a bit. We met... And of course, these NATO schools, we worked together on those. Mm-hmm. And I visited Amsterdam as what was it now? I have to look it up. I can't find it. Oh, here we are. Yes, in 1993, I was the Jan van Goerns lecturer at the University of Amsterdam.
Oh, okay. That's on your CV, so I can get that information off of there.
And I also had a postdoc, one of his students, Ronnie van Doorn, a very nice chap, came work with us for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I've examined some of his students, and he examined mine. You know, so we've kept in quite close contact. And in fact, we visited them only about a year ago.
Oh, okay.
So... We go back a long way with Nico.
Now he just retired too, isn't he?
Yes, sort of.
Sort of, okay. Yeah, some of these people don't really retire, I guess.
No. Well, carrying on with my list then of people.
Okay.
Jean Futrelle, well, I really mentioned him, haven't I, with Wright Patterson Air Force Base, going to work over there in the summer of 65, and then. He invited me back to present the work in 66 at the Hayes TME, the 14 meeting.
So how did you first get us associated with each other?
Well, I think I told you about Jean Dubois was over talking to Brian Stevens about photochemistry.
Okay.
And Brian went over there to work with Jean Dubois sometime, and I was talking to him, and he said, well, we've got a mass spectroscopist. We'd like to come and work with him. I said, great, yes. Mm-hmm. So I went over in the summer of 65. Jean talked to Jean. Jean raised some money. And I went over and worked on this tropillium heat formation stuff. And spent 3 months there. And that really was my introduction to American mass spectroscopy, because I met a few visitors. And then the following year, of course, I went to ASTM.
So that was your first meeting?
Yes, first time I'd been to the States, yes. And the following year, the first meeting was, you suddenly began to meet people you'd read about.
And you got to enjoy those, quote, hospitality, quote, suites.
Yes, yes. The hostility suites. The
hostility suites. I can't believe that I did some of the things that I did at those.
Yeah. It was always very good to drink ginger ale. I watch other people drinking the Scotch.
Yes, well, particularly they could go on until ungodly hours.
Quite so.
They've really tamed things up or down, I guess, it's, at the meeting now. But
I should hope so.
It's probably a necessity for the size of the meeting.
But I kept in touch with Jean. I mean, we saw each other last, I think, in the Prague meeting. 2006. But we exchanged Christmas cards and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done anything scientific together for some years. Now Mike Bowers, I started with him really about 68 when we found we were both working on ICR of alkenes. And that grew into, we were both non-Baltic Sphere people, you see. So that threw us together a little bit, because the Baltic Sphere group were terribly close-knit and gave you the impression that if you hadn't been through Baltic Sphere's lab, what were you doing working on ICR? Because you couldn't possibly know what you were doing.
Okay, one of those superiority things.
Yes. So the outsiders tended to band together a little bit. And Mike had actually had to build his own ICR machine. He hadn't been given funds to buy one. So we got to know each other quite well and started to visit each other. And he'd spent two periods here on sabbatical leave.
Okay.
And I spent one period there on sabbatical leave. We published probably 10 or a dozen papers together.
So where did he, where was he when you guys first got together? What school was he?
UCSB has been there ever since.
Okay, so this has been Santa Barbara the whole time.
Yeah. Yes, I think he worked in the jet propulsion lab for a bit and then went to Santa Barbara as a young lecturer, and he's been there ever since. So, yeah, we've known him since the late 60s.
So how many other of these non-Baltic Sphere people were there? You already had some impact. You had the
There's Maurice Percy was one.
Oh, okay.
North Carolina. Jack Hennis worked, I think, for Monsanto, and he was one.
How do you spell that last name?
I think it's H-E-N-I-S.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a, you know, there's a lot of one-upmanship, comments like, well, you know, how anybody living east of the Rockies could possibly know anything about ICR.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Very uppity.
No, it was all in good fun. And I had a very good postdoc from Mike coming up, from Lou Bass, who was a theoretician.
How do you spell that one?
Well, Lou and then B-A-double-S.
Oh.
I think it's spelled as L-E-W, not L-O-U.
Ah, L-E-W. Okay.
And Mike has been a lecturer at most of the NATO meetings, not all of them. But most
Gross, is that her?
No, Mike Barris.
Oh, Mike, oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Barris.
If I've got Gross down, I have got him down later.
Oh, okay.
Put him at the end of my list. I've forgotten him. But I'll come back again to Mike in a bit. Well, the other thing was, I think he has been instrumental to some extent in nominating me for one or two awards.
Oh, okay.
I got the Distinguished Contribution Award and the Field of Franklin Award, and I suspect he's at least in part due to that. Oh, so I felt responsible for that, sorry. And he's still in touch with Warwick, because he was over here last September. And I think he's coming over next September, according to Jim. So my association with him has now been handed on to Jim Scribner,
oh, okay.
So to speak. Which is why I know all about the iron mobility work and so on. But, in fact, one of Jim's people was in Mike's lab for January doing some measurements. Well, next on my list, I had Auslus and Lias, but we already discussed that, NBS and NATO, really. Then Graham Cooks. Well, I've known Graham since he was a PhD student in Cambridge with Dudley Williams.
Now, so where were you in your career?
Well, I was in Sheffield then as a young lecturer. And Graham had got his PhD in Natal, but left South Africa to come to Cambridge, did another PhD with Dudley Williams. And he was also interested in metastables at the time. And so we got to know each other then when he was in Britain, and kept in touch really ever since. And,
so you met because of the common scientific interest?
Yes, yes. Well, he was working with Dudley Williams, and I was mixed with Dudley quite a bit. In fact, Dudley's on my list to talk about in a while. And Graham's invited me to Purdue several times, and I've given help to a course of lectures there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, he spent sabbatical leave here, 3 months.
And so he elected to go to the States. Do you know if there's any motivation for that in his just better opportunities, you suppose?
Or? I think it's probably better opportunities, yes.
When did he get out of Cambridge with a second degree?
He was in Cambridge, I would say, about 66 to 8, something like that. Thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over to spend time with us, I would imagine, in the 80s. I could look it up, but I can't remember exactly.
Well, he's been extremely productive.
Oh, yes.
At Purdue.
Heavens, yes. It's a marvelous work.
Yeah, and I think he's one of the motivators behind the Zorby Trap thing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I know he consults with whatever it is now, Thermal Fisher or what have you. Mm. I can't keep track of the.
Yeah.
I mean, he used to be Finnegan, Thermal Finnegan or what have you.
But quite, yeah. Quite, yeah.
So I think he's been one of the. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that he's been a pusher there.
Mm.
Well, you want to take a break?
If you like. McCall was my next one. You want to do McCall?
Okay. How do you spell it?
M-A-C-C-O-L-L.
Okay.
Alan McCall.
A-L-E-N?
A-L-L.
Double L.
Yeah. Born in Scotland, but with a strong Australian accent. He lived in Sydney for a long time.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. So what was that about that he went from?
Oh, he came back to University College London. He was the prime motivator behind starting Organic Mass Spectrometry Journal and the British Mass Spectrometry Society.
Okay.
And I mean, he used to work on gas kinetics, pyrolysis in particular, and he was sort of like a father figure almost to us all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he died some years ago at 84,
mm-hmm.
but he'd be 90 now if he was still around. His mm. wife died only about 2 years ago.
Mm.
But he was very strong on the fundamentals.
So where did he operate out of?
University College London.
Oh, okay. Really, that's where, okay.
And, I examined his students, he examined mine. He always liked to talk about, let me get this right. Yes, PIMS number one and PIMS number two.
PIMS.
Now, you know the drink PIMS, yeah?
Vaguely familiar with it, but yeah.
Yes, well, to him, PIMS was photoionization mass spectrometry.
No, I see.
And penning ionization mass spectrometry.
I see.
This is one of his jokes.
I see.
I mean,
so what, one was photoionization, yeah. And the other was penning?
Yes. Alan's characteristic pose is fifth along on the top row.
And I'd like to take a picture of this with the, I see, has a large mug of,
indeed, yes.
of beer about to be imbibed.
Indeed, very hospitable guy. And, I think very few people would say they didn't like him. Mm. We got on very well with him.
So when I talked to John, he seemed to think there was some confusion about the first chair of that British Mass Spectrometry Society. He thought he had been more involved in it in the beginning, and then apparently the records showed.
Well, I'm not sure, actually. I have to say that one of the few people who did get on with Alan was John.
Oh, okay.
I don't quite understand this. I think there must be some background to it, which, I mean, I'm not privy to.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, John was undoubtedly the leading mass spectroscopist in Britain. Nobody would ever mm-hmm. question that.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't an academic.
Mm.
And I think Alan, as the academic, perhaps did more towards pushing the subject with a society and the journal.
Mm-hmm.
John has always been very keen on a world mass spectrometry society, which I think Graham is involved with now, mm-hmm. Nico is, I think. I've never seen the point of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't have joint meetings with the Martians or anything like that, can you? But there is certainly a bit of tension about being assessed at one stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, currently it is nothing like the Americans at all. There are few British academics now working who are really very involved with it. It's become much more commercial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people working in industry, FISAs, some analytical, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a time when British academics ran it.
Mm-hmm.
Alan McCall, Di Games, myself, John. But we've all sort of either retired or fallen away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's run almost entirely by industrial people.
Mm-hmm. How many people, what's this general membership of the BMSS? Do you have any sense of it? Is it several hundred thousand?
I would think it's at least a couple of hundred, yes.
Couple hundred.
I'll talk a bit more about that later.
Okay.
I don't know the background to very early days.
That's the only comment that he kind of made that I got was kind of a little negatory. You know, I mean, the fact that he thought there was some, he thought he had a bigger role in getting it started than apparently other people did, or whatever.
Well, yes, to be fair, he was running what you might call the mass spectroscopy group, which was a very informal get together at ICI.
Okay.
And then a chap called Peter Newstub tended to run, that's KNEW, Stub, double B, tended to run the mass spectrometry discussion group. But that was very much more small mass spectrometers. I mean, he might make his own time of flight. Or
mm-hmm.
And they, as I think I told you, were called the lunatic fringe because they would bore holes in their mass spectrometer,
mm-hmm.
take the hacksaw to them and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
John's was really more for users of commercial instruments. And out of this, somehow, the British Mass Spec Society grew
mm-hmm.
at a time when I was just getting involved, so I
yeah,
don't have any real background to what happened. Mm.
And so your interaction with McCall was just as an associate? Did you do any... You examined each other's students?
Yes, and we met at conferences... I remember going to a conference to celebrate, I think it was his 70th birthday, and the speaker and things like that. And
so he's an esteemed colleague. But
oh, yes, very much so. As I say, he was almost like a father figure in a different way from John. John dominated things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very... he took control of the situation. In a room, John was in charge, you see what I mean.
I see, okay.
He was that sort of person.
Sounds like Frank Field.
Yeah, a bit like that, yeah. You know he was there.
Yeah.
You never find John quietly in a corner. He's always telling jokes. He had an infinite supply of jokes where he got them all from.
Yeah.
Well, next I had Elliot and Evans, and that really is a carry-on from Barber and Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mick Barber left AEI to go into UMIST
mm-hmm.
about 1967-ish, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marty Elliot started to work with Sid Evans
mm-hmm.
at Kratos, and I worked together with them for probably about 15 years. Mm-hmm. Although I think in the end Marty Elliot moved to a different section. But much of the work on CID, link scans, MS-9, MS-10, MS-50, four-sector, was all done with them.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think I said last night, they were able to develop a technique, but they didn't have a chemist to use it. So I was almost used as an adjunct.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, here's a technique, what do you think you can do with
yeah.
it? We'll give you the technique, but go and do something useful with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So
polish a paper with it.
Yeah. I was quite happy with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sydney, it was spelled S-Y-D, was it Sydney?
Well, I think it's S-I-D-N-E-Y.
Oh, okay, S-I-D. Actually, when I was here visiting on pleasure a long time ago, sat with Elliot and Evans and his fellow Alan Eric.
Oh, it's Alan Eric, yes, yeah. yes. No, he was the electronics guy.
Yeah, and had a conversation amongst us, the four of us, mm-hmm. Which I have recorded.
mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if this has been transcribed. That was a freelance thing that I did because I was here and was able to get mm-hmm. these guys together at one point. So some of that from the AEI side, I'll be able to develop yeah. The story there, which is...
Yes, and Alan Eric was often the man who devised the electronics for the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was a great fine. I visited him, you know, actually separately when my wife and I were. I guess is he living in London or was living in London?
I don't know. I didn't know him as well as the other two.
Yeah, but we had actually visited him at his home within a second time. But that was just kind of like a you know a friendly visit.
Yeah.
But
Sid was the one who would discuss the hardware. You know, he'd know where the slits were,
mm-hmm.
and how many thou there was there, and what tolerance there was for this, and things mm-hmm. like that. Martin, I know, had written a quite good article on iron sources. I think that was his mm-hmm. forte. But if you said to Sid, I want to put a plate somewhere, and modify the something or other, and it was Sid who would know the workshop drawings in his head
mm.
and tell you that you couldn't do that because of the thing
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Alan is the one who would know what the circuit was like for the magnet stabilization mm-hmm. power supply mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. But they were a fine group to work with. I really enjoyed my association with AI.
Well, it was a kind of a special time, I think, in these companies where people who had technical expertise were respected for it and were given mm-hmm. opportunities to use it and show how they could make a contribution. But today, I don't think that management is sufficiently enlightened to understand mm-hmm. the importance of people who have good, strong technical and scientific knowledge, and then just. They're just somebody who's stuck away salary and they don't see anything other than, you know, where's my quarterly profit from you?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a sad situation, but it certainly dominates American industry today.
Well, certainly in the 60s and early 70s, it was like, well, we're not going to university. I mean, I actually considered joining.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah.
I talked to John Waldron about this, and he essentially said, well, I'd be careful, you know, seemed very happy in university surroundings and think carefully about it. And he was right, I think.
Well, I mean, Gareth Britton had spent, you know,
time
with them before he went back to Swansea.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's the attitude in the industry was very much, I mean, I'm not totally academic, but it had a very strong flavor of being permissive with people to do what they thought best and to use their intelligence to move the field forward rather than being managed by some guy who can only observe how much money is being spent and how much is coming in.
Quite, yes.
And that's such a sad approach to things.
I used to turn up at AI about 10:30 and we'd talk science nonstop.
Sure.
At 3:30, then I'd go home across the snake. Back to Sheffield.
Yeah.
Anyway, perhaps we should see about lunch. Otherwise,
okay.
Expecting us about 1:00.
Well, yeah, we'll turn off the recorder for a while and rest our bodies.